Today is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and in honor of the holiday, we're speaking with Assemblyman Charles Barron, a Brooklyn Democrat, who is one of the most eloquent speakers in the state legislature when it comes to race and politics and where they intersect. Welcome to the show, Assemblyman.
Thank you. It's an honor, and I appreciate being on it. Happy New Year to everyone.
So for starters, and I know this is broad, but what does the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday mean to you? Is the day about memorializing the man, thinking about the issues he fought for, or something else entirely?
Well, to me, it represents an opportunity for those of us who study Dr. King to unfreeze him in history. They froze Dr. King in history to his I Have a Dream speech, integration. And now it's an opportunity to say, what about the radical King? In 1967, 1968, King's integration move went to a more radical, revolutionary message of equitable distribution of wealth, democratic socialism, wanting an end to imperialist wars. It was Dr. King that said, I fought hard to reform some of the institutions in the South, a little change here, a little change there, but now I think that the entire society needs a radical transformation and a revolution of values. That is Dr. King that said to his good friend, Harry Belafonte, before he died and shortly before he was assassinated, he said, Harry, perhaps I'm trying to integrate into a burning house. We need to move in another direction. So I'm hoping that the radical Dr. King can be unveiled. Dr. King that died during his last days fighting poverty, a poor people's campaign, and he had some militant action. He was going to stop planes from taking off, stop traffic, until he got a multi-billion-dollar anti-poverty king. That's the king we should worship and honor.
Well, I'm glad you bring up the idea of unfreezing King, because, you know, in society today, he is a figure who I think is almost universally revered, and I wonder, though, how much of that memory, that collective memory we have, is based on almost like a whitewashed idea of King, where people, you know, don't really recognize or acknowledge the aspects that they might not be so comfortable with. And I'm curious, you know, that version of King, you know, where do you think he would fit in today's society? Do you think he would be met with the admiration, that we have for the historical figure? Or do you think he would face some of the same backlash that like the Black Lives Matter movement faces today?
I think even greater than the Black Lives Matter movement, he would suffer from serious backlash, because even in his last days, if you look at King of 1968, his own leaders around him didn't want him to speak out against the Vietnam War. Black ministers, he couldn't find a black church to speak in once he started taking on President Johnson and speaking against the war, and not only against the war, but against the domestic, he called it domestic colony, that we black communities, we're in ghettos, and they're like domestic colonies of capitalism. And he said that in the so-called ghettos, that we need to gain power to determine the destiny of our local communities and let it go beyond us just looking for jobs and things like that. He sounded like the Black Panther Party's first point on the Black Panther Party's 10-point program. We want to control the destiny of our black communities. So that Dr. King, he would be attacked now, because he would attack, I believe, both Trump and Biden. And he would attack the colonial capitalist administrator of this capitalist system, whether it was a Barack Obama or whether it was a Donald Trump, a racist, fascist, or whether it was a neoliberal racism of Biden. King would attack all of that, and he would be in real, real trouble, because he had a prophetic, dynamic, radical vision for revolutionary change in America.
The current fight against racism in society feels like a much more leaderless campaign than 60 years ago, when you could point to people like King and some of his peers. Is it fair to label the two periods like that, though? And if so, do you think one tact or the other is better at bringing about meaningful change?
I think the idea of mobilizing around a singular issue, even if it's something as serious as police brutality, the idea of mobilizing around a singular issue for just jobs, or a singular issue for housing, or a singular issue for health care. When you do mobilizing around these singular issues, it is not as potent as organizing for power and systemic change. So if you have a colonial capitalist system with its imperialistic, warmongering foreign policy, if that system is creating poverty, creating homelessness, creating all of the thousands of a myriad of social issues that is impacting our community, and you don't get to the root of the problem, which is capitalism, and you're still dealing with the symptoms, then you're not going to have the kind of impact that needs to be had in this 21st century. We have to organize for power and systemic change, not just dealing with the symptoms.
In honor of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, we're talking about race and politics, and our guest is Assemblyman Charles Barron. You talked about capitalism being at the root of some of these problems. Why do you think capitalism is to blame here?
Because it's a greedy, blood-sucking, class division system, definitely sexist, racist, and classist. And so if I fight against racism, then I'm fighting for inclusion into a fatally flawed capitalist system that needs to be radically, systemically changed. So, for instance, if I want to get more into government, more blacks into government, well, we had a black president. And we have over 13, 14,000 black elected officials across this nation. In New York City, we have a black head of the state assembly, black head of the Senate. We have a black attorney general. We have a black public advocate. We have a black head of the Democratic Party in Brooklyn, Manhattan, Queens, and the Bronx. And we still get more black poverty than we've ever had. So we need to fight for systemic change. And if you fight just for racism, they'll give you manufactured leaders. By the way, Dr. King said the white power structure gives black leaders prestigious positions and resources. And he said the black masses are angry at these manufactured leaders that the white power structure puts in place in order to maintain capitalism. So I think we got to go beyond the fight of racism, and black people need black power in the 21st century. Because once you have power, that's the great equalizer. It won't matter what people think about us in terms of our race. That would be an irrelevant discussion when you have power.
When it comes to promoting equality or addressing racism within the structures that we have now through our current, you know, government, does change only happen at the ballot box by electing lawmakers committed to these policies, or are there other ways to bring about change? I mean, is it possible to actually persuade incumbent elected officials who heretofore have not been willing to embrace these types of policies?
You know, if you look at most of the social policies that were advanced in this country for us, whether it was the Voting Rights Act or the Civil Rights Act, most people don't even know who the sponsors of those bills were. But they know that Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights Movement and the Black Panthers and the Black Power Movement and Black nationalist organizations like the Nation of Islam and other groups and the Republic of New Africa Movement led to the influence of people in power to pass legislation. The Black Lives Matter movement led people to pass legislation in the state assembly that had been sitting around for 10 years. You know, chokehold bill, that's been around for a long time. The police supposed to be not be able to do it, but that passed now because of the streets movement. And all of those other bills that were passed been around, but because of the street movement mobilizing and organizing and putting pressure. There's a difference between influence and power. When you don't have the power to make decisions in your best interest, and you have to march and demonstrate and scream and holler to get people in power to make those decisions, that's influence. But I think that electoral politics has its limitations. It is the mobilization and organizing people in the streets of America and definitely of New York State to say it's business cannot, will not go on as usual until there's some systemic change.
Well, you mentioned the package of bills that were passed last summer by the legislature. One of those bills had to do with creating Juneteenth and making it a public holiday in New York. Do you think this was meaningful action, or was it essentially just low-hanging fruit at a time when politicians, including the governor, wanted to respond to a national movement?
I think it was the governor co-opting and placating our movement. We didn't ask him for no Juneteenth holiday. I mean, we were celebrating that anyway. We didn't need his permission. He put that out there because he didn't want to do what he really should have done, and that is not to pass a budget that cuts $2.5 billion from Medicaid, $400 million from hospitals, revamped and did the whole bill on bail reform, brought that back and watered that down so judges have more discretion to put us in jail, cut the money, $400 million from the NYCHA budget. He did all of this, and including allowing or forcing COVID patients to be in nursing homes with the most vulnerable people, and then writes a book about how he was so great during the pandemic. So I think that those contradictions coming from the governor is part of placating. You know, everybody talks about defunding the police, even the mayor and the police commissioner. Okay, we'll defund the police. They never defunded the police. They transferred money from one part of the budget to the other part of the budget. So when they try to co-opt terms like defunding and the bills that the governor co-opted and made it seem like we really did something. Matter of fact, a few weeks after the chokehold bill was codified as law, they choked the young man in Queens. So, you know, I think that the governor placates us, and we didn't ask for that. If he wants to do something for black people, how about reparations, governor? Reparations. One of the largest slaveholding cities in the country was New York City and New York State. He was placating us.
And after a quick break, we'll have more about race and politics with Brooklyn Assemblyman Charles Barron.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and health care.
We're continuing our conversation about race and politics, and our guest is Brooklyn Assemblyman Charles Barron. So during your remarks on the Juneteenth bill, you made the case that the more meaningful policy to be tackling was reparations, although it is a much more controversial measure. In the past, you've carried a bill establishing a commission to study reparations for African Americans and make recommendations on the topic, a much less controversial first step in this process. Why has that bill never come up for a vote in the legislature, let alone the assembly?
Well, we have 50 people on board with the bill. I think the leaders in the assembly, even though they're black, the leaders in the state senate, even though she's black, are too controlled by the governor. I don't think the governor wants it, and I don't think they want to take on the governor and make it happen. You would think with a black head of the assembly, black head of the senate, and a majority Democrats in the assembly, a majority Democrats in the senate, that bill would be passed. And what is the bill saying? We just want to set up a community commission on reparations to recommend remedy, solution.
Yeah. I mean, I don't understand. Why would someone be afraid
right.
of that? Is it about the fear of dredging up the history? Is it the fear that it actually leads to something? Is it the fear that it might lead to something?
No, I think it's the fear that they will go against the governor. They will go against the mayor. They would have to go against white men in power who don't want to see that issue dealt with. So, and I think that's why Martin Luther King called them manufactured leaders. They go, if they love Martin Luther King so much, he was for reparation. Martin Luther King was for reparation. Honor King by saying we're going to take this bill that's simply calling for a commission to be put together that's a community control to let you know what we think we should get as reparations. But they won't even do that in the name of Martin Luther King because the white power structure still controls black leadership.
Have you thought about what form reparations could and should take in New York and the rest of the country?
Well, what I decided to do is that let the commission decide that. But for me, since you asked, and that's a very good question, we got to make sure we don't misunderstand reparations. Reparations is a debt owed for enslavement and Jim Crowism. It's a debt owed. So don't tell us we're going to give you some scholarships and that's your reparations, or we're going to give you more poverty programs and that's your reparations. No, that's what we should get as taxpaying citizens when you're discriminating against us. So I think reparations should be land and cash. There should be a tremendous amount of cash. I heard different numbers. I heard the number $4 trillion. I heard $6 trillion. And of course, you know, that would be the whole national budget. So I'm not saying give all of that, but there should be a multi-billion dollar cash deposit in a central bank and land given to our people so that we can then develop on that land with the cash institutions that we think will be vital to our survival and to help us thrive.
If the state or the country was to advance reparations, do you think that that conversation should include indigenous people who also have gotten a very raw deal by the founders of this country?
I'm focusing on black people.
Okay.
Because every time we talk about something, people want us to include everybody. I support indigenous people 100% getting reparations. And you know what? They have gotten some. The Japanese got reparations when they were interned in 1942. And in 1988, the Reagan administration, they got over $1.6 billion in reparations. Jews are still getting reparations. As a matter of fact, the city council gave $1 million to Holocaust survivors, and New York had nothing to do with the Holocaust. So this is for African people. And we've been enslaved in Africa. We've been enslaved in the Caribbean. And we've been enslaved in the Americas. We're focusing on African people, and we support any other oppressed people, especially the indigenous people, because this land was stolen from them. So I support them getting reparations 1,000%. But every time we talk about something, we got to include everybody, and other nationalities and ethnicities. They do things primarily for Asians, primarily for Latinos, and some Latinos are African. And primarily for Irish, primarily for Polish, Jewish. But when it comes to us, we have to always include everybody. So I'm focusing on African people in America receiving reparations and African people around the diaspora receiving their reparations from Europe.
In the wake of the killing of George Floyd and the subsequent protest, there seemed to be an increased level of introspection by white people about the way society is stacked in their favor. Did you notice any change like that, or is this just my skewed opinion based on, you know, white woke Twitter?
Well, you know, that's why I say we should focus on colonial capitalism and its racist ideology, mm-hmm. and white people confessing that they have been privileged, and white people confessing that there is racism. See, everybody is going to talk against racism now. Even racists are talking against racism because it's popular. And it doesn't, you don't have to do anything. And then the little stuff that you do is not going to change the living condition of our people. If white people were really serious about our oppression and the relationship with government and the people of America, they would speak out against capitalism. They would speak out against economic oppression in our community. They would speak out against the fact that, yeah, we suffered the most deaths from the coronavirus, but the governor decided to bring a ship to the white community and have 1,000 beds on them. They didn't even use them all, or renovate or do something with the Javits Center in the white community, with Central Park in the white community, and nothing near that for the black community and the brown community that was dying the most. So white people waking up and saying, oh, my God, you know, I'm privileged and racism is wrong, is not what I seek. I seek them to, one, in their communities and in their country and in their politics, they should fight against colonial capitalism and its racist ideology and imperialistic wars abroad.
You've talked about the legislative leaders and their will or lack thereof to make real significant change. I'm curious what you think, though, about your rank-and-file colleagues, many of whom are new in the Assembly this year. What's your impression of the assembly members that you are with on the Democratic side?
Well, a lot of them profess socialism and profess progressiveness and said they wanted to see systemic change and that they're going to fight for that. Time will tell. And you can tell by whether or not they vote for budgets that oppress, whether or not they vote for gentrifying projects that will gentrify our neighborhoods, whether they are bold enough to stand up to the speaker, to the majority leader in the Senate, and stand up to the governor, because they all three work in concert to come up with budgets that are far less humane and sensitive to oppression in our communities. How do you have over $180 billion of a state budget and a $90 billion plus city budget, $270 billion in one state? And you're talking to me about Donald Trump. You're waiting on Trump to give you something from the feds before you come up with a revenue package. How could you have a budget without a revenue package? How could you not want to tax the rich? Look at the governor and his hypocritical state of the state, telling the feds to tax the rich, and then he doesn't even want to do that in the state, saying if he did that, you'd only get $1.6 billion anyway. That's a lie. If you did the right percentage, if you did the stock transfer tax, if you did a capital gains tax and so many others on the rich, you can get $30 to $40 billion and have a surplus every year. For you not to do that, for the Assembly and the Senate not to do that, is unconscionable and unacceptable.
Well, we've been speaking with Assemblyman Charles Barron, a Brooklyn Democrat. Assemblymember, thank you so much for making the time. I really enjoyed this.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by Destiny USA. Shopping, dining, and entertainment all in one location. For more information, go to www.destinyusa.com.